This material is subject to copyright. No unauthorized recording, editing, copying, or distribution is permitted without the consent of the Economic Research Council. All rights reserved. For more information, visit www.ercouncil.org. Audio lectures by the Economic Research Council.
Now, John Stevens is going to start off. He is an architect of the euro, one of the architects of the euro. He conducted all the legislation for the creation of the euro through the European Parliament between 1989 and 1999. So I can say that he is very keen on the subject, and he's very good on the subject, and he is going to lead off. John Peat will then follow with the economist's view, as he is a balanced, reasoned economist with a wide background of reporting everything from the middle ground and doing all the pros and cons and the five different opinions for the two subjects that he's opining on. And Norman has stepped into the breach to do the not-so-pro-euro, European euro position, as he has been for, I think, virtually all his life, not a, a great proponent of this economic experiment. I hope there's no barracking is going to go on this evening. I will endeavour to keep some order. We'll ask the speakers to do 10 minutes each, and then questions, and we'll have to close it at 8:30. So let the discussion commence. John, fantastic.
Don't mind that.
No, not at all. No. Perfect. Well, thank you very much for inviting me in such distinguished company. I feel slightly like one of the early Christians having to not renounce my beliefs, since of late anybody who's been even remotely pro the euro has been harassed and required to recant. I'm not quite sure whether this is a persecution of Diocletian, however, or that of Domitian. I don't know how long we've got to wait. But parallels from the first century are, I think, of some relevance here, because I also note that in dealing with the opponents of the euro, one is reminded of the early Christian belief that the world was about to come to an end imminently, and that all you had to do was to wait and Armageddon would appear. And wisdom and the conversion of the Roman Empire to the ideal of monotheism came essentially when that idea was given up. The euro, those who've supported it from the start, I think, have always, most of us have said that we always recognised that at the start it was an incomplete exercise, and that it was, in the true way in which all European integration has taken place, it was going to force further developments. And the debate at the moment is really about the nature of those developments, and that debate has always been essentially a political one. It's been no different from the political debate that you have domestically between whether further progress, the logic of having a single market and then a single currency, drives you in a regulatory and government-orientated, tax-orientated, fiscal harmonisation, fiscal integration path, or whether it is a more market-orientated with strict rules, with fiscal disciplines, with market disciplines. And that's really the debate that we've got still now. You've got, broadly speaking, the Germans favouring a more free market approach with rules and wanting the private sector investors to take the hit. And you've got the French talking more about having fiscal harmonisation, large-scale structural funds and all the rest. But it's important to see that this debate is essentially a left-right debate. And it is no one, I think, on the continent certainly, was under any illusions that the creation of the euro was going to lead to other developments, political and economic developments, institutional developments in due course. And in the sense that European progress has always taken place in the context of crisis, there is nothing unusual about this situation. And I think that's particularly the case if you recognize that the crisis that we've got in Europe is essentially a supercharged version and a concentrated version of the crisis that we have globally. And we have enormous problems of global imbalances, fiscal imbalances, trade imbalances. We have a global banking crisis. We have a question about the stability of the global currency, of the medium of exchange, the future of the dollar, debates about whether we should be revisiting the Stone Age and reintroducing gold, talk about the SDR. And one of the few things I certainly very strongly always agree with Keynes on is that gold is just jewellery. But nevertheless, it is extraordinary that you've got now in this time debates about the nature of fiat currency, the sustainability of fiat currency at a global level, and you've got the similar debate at a European level. And so one of the questions in judging the euro crisis is to say, well, which is easier to sort out? Is it going to be easier to sort out the imbalances between China and the US or between Greece and Germany? And I think I know the answer to that. I mean, it is going to be a lot easier to sort out things in a European context. And maybe that is the lesson of this crisis, that we have a situation where it may be no longer possible to address the enormous problems that we have in global imbalances and in the sustainability of the financial system at a global level. And this is really, I think, the crucial issue. Are we about to move from a world essentially dominated by a process of globalization that was benign, that was led by the United States, into a world which is likely to be more regionalized? And that is, it seems to me, the political issue behind the development of the euro and where it goes from here. Now, in comparing it, the problems of the eurozone with the problems globally, I'm saying essentially that they're the same. It's a banking crisis. It's a crisis of the sustainability of government debt and of trade imbalances at a global level and at a European level. Although it is very easy to see, like the early Christians, how the roof could fall in and we could have a complete disaster. On the whole, I would still say that we are likely to muddle through in some way. There will be a muddling through at a global level, and there will also be a muddling through at a European level. The elements of what needs to happen are pretty clear. They're clear in the European level than they are at a global level. I would say that there are three elements, essentially. We need to get a situation in which the private investors pay for assuming that Greek debt is the same as German debt. So there has to be a haircut of some kind for the debts of Greece, Portugal, of Ireland probably, maybe Spain. There has to be an arrangement in which there is a management of the debt, maybe rescheduling. You can argue the details of this, but that's clearly one element here that you've got to have. There has to be a market risk in this, that the real error was to get into this cloud cuckoo land of imagining that Greek government bonds are the same as German government bonds. And the whole point of creating the euro, from the point of view of someone like myself who favours a free market approach, is that by creating a single currency, by taking away from governments the power to devalue and to print and therefore defraud their creditors, you are making governments the same as any other creditors. And that is my view, is a very positive development. And I would go further to say that what this euro crisis has done, in all its brutality and all its chaos, has been to expose things that really needed being exposed. The corruption, the inefficiency of Greek government, of the Irish government, of a whole range of governments. The illusions that we've had about the way in which a lot of our monetary affairs have been arranged. And the illusion, perhaps also more broadly, about the competitive position of the European economy. And if this crisis forces a discipline that allows those issues to be confronted, then that, in my view, is an extremely positive development. Now, in addition to the to the haircuts. We need to have sort out the European banking system. And clearly there is a far too many banks in Europe. A lot of them are bust. There needs to be a European TARP, essentially. And I think, again, this is something which policymakers are moving towards. But as at a global level in dealing with the risk of insolvency of the banking system, there are an awful lot of cross currents here. And clearly, in particular, what has happened in European debt markets has made it much more difficult for the Basel III process, for the reserve requirements of banks. Those rules have been actually had a torpedo put right through the middle of them, because the quality of a lot of this debt has clearly been shown up as not what was assumed under the rules that were only very recently drawn up. So this is an ongoing story clearly. The final element is that you will need, in my view, to have some form of European bond issuance in the name of Europe. Now, at the moment, the Germans are saying they don't want this, and I can quite understand why they don't want to let. But I'm absolutely convinced that the end of this story is going to be that. And the real question, I think, about the way in which this crisis is likely to develop is what the price is that the Germans are going to require for having a European issuance of some kind, and what rules they attach to it. So I come back to it. What we're really talking about here is a political debate, a crisis that is similar essentially to, or is a supercharged version of an intense version of what is a global crisis. The debate about which measures are required to solve it is essentially a left-right debate. What will worry me is if we get a shift in political power in Germany and France over the next. I mean, you've got presidential elections in France in 2012. You've got the German elections in 2013. If you get a shift to the left, then that will clearly colour the way in which this crisis works out. What I'm absolutely convinced of is that, I mean, everything depends on whether we get growth or not in the world now. I mean, that's true of working out the imbalances between the US and China. It's certainly true of sorting out the Eurozone. If we get reasonable growth now, then the muddling through the management of the crisis is likely. If we don't, then I think a more likely scenario is that you get a much more intense integration of the Eurozone, which would be hostile potentially to those on the outside or to the periphery. But what I'm absolutely convinced that on either of those scenarios, the euro survives. But I'm quite sure which scenario is more benign, not just for the eurozone itself, but also for people outside it, in particular the UK. Because the real lesson of this crisis, and this is where I conclude, is that the real lesson has been to expose the competitive weaknesses of the European economy. And that is only a subset of the competitive weaknesses of the West in general that have been exposed by this crisis. And we have seen an enormous, unprecedented shift of power from West to East. Now, you can argue what the true significance of that is in political terms, in economic terms. You can argue whether the Western social, economic, political model even of free societies and free economies are still valid. I mean, this is an enormous shift. But what it does mean is that the case for Europeans hanging together of a greater degree of unity in Europe is much stronger now. The rise of Asia, in my view, and the challenge that constitutes is what is going to make it, in my view, is going to ensure that the euro survives.
I'm not used to being in the middle, but I am a journalist, so it's not a bad position to occupy. Yes, the euro. Well, where did we start with the euro crisis? I take you back for a moment to something called the Stability Pact. I was in Brussels, actually. I think John was also a member of the European Parliament at the time. There was always a problem with the euro. And I think the problem was, what do you do about fiscal policy? The German solution to that problem was the Stability Pact. And I've talked to Theo Weigel about the Stability Pact, and he has said several times to me, they should not have let Greece into the euro. Well, you know, he wasn't there when they did it. But the real problem with the Stability Pact, there were two problems with the Stability Pact. One was, nobody ever believed they were going to fine members of the euro area for exceeding the limits on the budget deficit. But the second was that the first country to breach the Stability Pact was Germany. And as soon as Germany and France had breached the Stability Pact, this was under Gerhard Schröder as the Chancellor, the whole thing became utterly implausible. From that moment, 2001, 2002, it was quite clear that restrictions on fiscal deficits in the euro area had no credibility. And actually, as a journalist, what surprised me about the financial markets, and of course, I come from The Economist, I believe the markets are always right, the markets know everything, the free market is what we stand for, and the best way of running any system is to rely on the markets. The astonishing thing to me, and I was in Brussels for part of the time and then I came back to London, was that the bond market seemed to me to take a very long time to wake up to what happened when Germany and France breached the Stability Pact. What happened then to me, as an outside observer, journalist, not somebody with any money, therefore I'm not an investor, was that immediately that happened, the credibility of countries like Greece, Ireland, Portugal, Italy and Spain should have been shot to pieces. And it took an astonishingly long time for the markets to wake up to that. Of course, it was the Greek lies about their numbers that really came home to the bond markets. And we then had the crisis in May and the bailout of Greece, followed by what's recently happened with Ireland. But I take the view that some crisis like this was almost inevitable from the moment that Germany and France breached the Stability Pact. Why are countries in the euro so vulnerable after 10 years? We knew, and I wrote about the problems of Italy and Belgium from the very beginning of this project. It was quite clear that they were the two countries that we should worry most about. They were the countries that worried people like Theo Weigel. And interestingly, those two countries, the most vulnerable ones, have been the most careful about their debt position. What we didn't realise, and I would have to admit as a journalist, I didn't realise, was how terrible the situation could develop because of Greece, Ireland, Portugal and Spain. And in a way, I think they were victims of their own success. I don't think it's fair to say that their problems have been caused by the euro. I would note simply that Iceland, Latvia, Romania, Hungary, even to some extent the United Kingdom, we've all experienced problems, we've had bubbles, we've had difficulties with the banking system. I think it would be overselling it to say that their problems were caused by the euro. But I do think what happened once these countries joined the euro is they became overly complacent about their situation. And that complacency, I think, took three forms, which they all shared to some extent. The first was, let's not worry about our public finances. Stability Pact, forget about it. The Germans and the French have already breached the limits. We don't need to worry about it. That was particularly true for Greece and Portugal. Greece especially, because their numbers anyway were totally bogus. Second aspect of complacency. Let's have a property boom. We don't mind about property booms. I mean, you know, the Americans are having a property boom. The British are having a property boom. It doesn't really matter about asset prices going up too fast. We'll reap the tax proceeds. It's great. That was sort of the Irish-Spanish problem. And the third aspect of complacency was to forget about the banks. We don't care if the banks are lending a lot of money. We don't care if they're lending money particularly for property. That's, you know, their problem. We don't need to control their lending. We don't need to worry about their political links to parties. This is something that I think affected not just Ireland, but also to some extent this country as well. In each case, I think the euro may have contributed to a small extent, but I think it would be very erroneous to say the euro is responsible. Iceland had a much worse property bubble than Ireland. Britain's property bubble was pretty bad. Fortunately, we've escaped the worst consequences, I think largely because planning laws in this country prevented people from building too many houses, unlike in Ireland. But I think it would be very it would be an oversimplification to say that these countries had this boom because of the euro. They could have done something about it inside the euro, and plenty of countries outside the euro had the problem. However, I do think membership of the euro is making the cure much harder and more painful. Iceland and Britain, as we know, have suffered. Both countries are still suffering. But I think a currency devaluation in both cases is helping. So to that extent, I think the euro is making life much more difficult for countries like Ireland and Greece. I think they're stuck in the euro. I think to deal with their problems is going to require what you might call an internal devaluation. They're going to have to run primary surpluses to repay debt. And that is going to be challenging and extremely painful. I think Ireland might manage it. I'm not so sure about Greece, although I'm very impressed by Papakonstantidou. I'd worry rather more about the Iberian countries. And actually, underneath it all, I still worry about the country that we worried about most in the 1990s, which was Italy. So I think there is a big problem about the euro there. Now, some people will say, of course, Europe is lacking in leadership in tackling this general problem. I would agree with that. Europe is always lacking in leadership. I think it's rather like the US Congress. I think it was one of Norman Lamont's predecessors, Nigel Lawson, who once said that you can divide up public policy initiatives by finance ministries into too little too late and too much too late. And I think in the case of the Eurozone, it's been too little too late. I'm not sure that I would say that they're all to blame for that. I think it's an inevitability about the structure of the Eurozone. But I think that some of the leaders, notably Angela Merkel, have made things worse. You know, the quarrel with Jean-Claude Juncker that we've seen this week. The politics in Germany makes life much more difficult for Angela Merkel. She has a constitutional court to deal with. She has the tabloid Bild to deal with. She is moving, but she's moving slowly, grimly, and with evident reluctance towards a situation in which Germany helps the rest of the Eurozone. I don't think that adds up, in my book, to a fiscal union, but it does add up to one in which the Germans do help the rest of the Eurozone. I don't think there's a political will to move towards what you might call the United States of Europe, but I think that it is true that the Eurozone is quite likely to turn into something that begins to resemble more of a federal union than the rest of the European Union. We will have more intrusiveness from the centre, more help through the ECB. I don't think we will see a big federal budget because there's no appetite for that, but it will look slightly different from what we've got now. And I think that does have some implications for this country because I see in the future a bigger divide between the countries that are in the euro and the countries that are not in the euro. I'm not necessarily saying that we should immediately therefore join, but I think we should recognise that that divide will grow in the future. But my real worry, and in a way this is the main point I want to make, is that all the argument about debt, euro bonds, dealing with the situation of Greece and Ireland, in some ways ignores the real underlying fault line that was always there in the euro project. And I speak as somebody who wasn't perhaps as strong a supporter as John Stevens, but was maybe more of a supporter of this idea than Norman Lamont. I thought that the idea of European Economic and Monetary Union might bring benefits to the European Union and the members of it. The reason why I thought it would bring benefits to those countries was because I thought that if they were in a single currency, they would be forced, perhaps it's a strong word, but it's a word that we like to use in journalism, they would be forced to introduce reforms that would make their economies more flexible, their labour markets more flexible. I subscribed very strongly to the Mundell view of single currencies. There are benefits to be had from a single currency that is bigger than a single country, and that it could apply to the European Union or some countries in the European Union. But it will only work if you have more flexible labour markets, more flexible product markets, if you reform your economies. And the real problem of the euro area, which I have to admit I think I got wrong as a correspondent in Brussels in the 1990s, was that that dynamic failed to work. I argued, as many journalists did in the late 1990s, that this would be a good idea provided countries like Italy, Spain, Portugal and Greece treated the European Economic and Monetary Union as a reason why they needed to apply serious reforms to their economies. They needed to make the labour markets more flexible in particular, but not only that, they needed to do general reforms, pensions, services, single market reforms of all sorts. And the real problem with the euro area, I think, is not the level of debt, although that has become, in a way, a proxy for the problem of the euro area. It's been that what happened in 1999 was that governments that got into the euro, and I particularly think of the Italian government in this context, treated it as something that solved their problem. They thought, all we've done is we've made a big effort, we've reduced our deficit, we've had a special euro tax, we've just about qualified, although they didn't qualify under the debt criterion, and they've let us in. And they thought that was it, no problem, they could now relax. Whereas the argument that I would have made would have been to say, if you get into the euro, that is the beginning of your problems and not the end of your problems. You needed much more seriously to address the competitiveness of your economy. And we've seen since Italy, Spain, Portugal, Ireland, Greece got into the euro that their unit labour costs against Germany have risen very substantially. Their competitive position has deteriorated hugely. And I think that's the biggest problem in the euro. It's been seen particularly by the continuance of current account surpluses in Germany and the Netherlands and large current account deficits in Spain and elsewhere. And my worry about the current situation is that I think they're not really addressing that as the big problem for the euro. My final word is to say, I think echoing what John said, I don't think the euro is going to collapse, mainly because I think the costs of it collapsing anywhere, and I include Germany and Ireland and other countries in this, outweigh the benefits of leaving. So I think the price of leaving the euro is going to be greater than the price of staying in it. But I do think there are serious problems because of competitiveness. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, I am very, very interested in this debate and in the developments recently because I was Britain's negotiator at Maastricht. My job, of course, was to keep Britain out of the euro, something I was enthusiastic to do. But I spent a whole year of my life listening to the architects of the euro and the plans for the euro, and the more I listened, the more I became convinced that this couldn't work. The reasons I thought it couldn't work was, firstly, I didn't believe you could have a common monetary and single interest rate for an area with divergent and different economies. I believed that wouldn't work in an area that was not, we've already had a reference to Robert Mundell, a natural single labour market and an optimal currency area. The fact that it was not a single labour market, to my mind, pointed in the direction of the necessity of fiscal transfers, which was ruled out. And because I felt the logic pointed to fiscal transfers, I felt the only way in which this could work ultimately was if it became a full centralized political union, if Europe became something like a government, something like a state, and that was something I was completely opposed to. What was interesting, as John Peet said, was how from the very beginning the rules were broken. I was rather surprised at his referring to Theo Weigel and the breaking of the Growth and Stability Pact, because I think Theo Weigel was the finance minister at the point that Germany broke it. But be that as it may, it was also the debt-to-GDP ratios that were completely ignored. Countries like Belgium, Italy, Austria. And, of course, the moment the single currency came into existence, another interesting divergence happened. That was the divergence of inflation rates. Interestingly, in order to qualify for the single currency, you had to have an interest rate that was within a given percentage of the central average rate of inflation of the whole EU. But the moment the currency was established, those convergence conditions broke apart and inflation rates became more and more diverse, which actually has helped to create the problem of the competitiveness of the southern countries to which John Peet referred. I very much agree with what John Peet said, that it would be wrong to say that it was the euro entirely that was the cause of the problems of countries like Ireland or Spain. The banking crisis, as he said, affected Iceland, affected us as well. But I think the common interest rate did play a part in exacerbating the boom, probably in Ireland and Spain. And I think another interest rate problem was the convergence of interest rates in the bond market. Because there was a no bailout rule, during the negotiations, the Germans, who were terrified that they would have to bail out the Italians, wrote in a no bailout rule. And because of that, countries like Italy, like Greece, like Ireland, but had a bit of a free ride. The markets failed to discriminate between the bonds of one country and the bonds of another. And this, I think, exacerbated the boom in some countries. And I think one of the things that has to happen, and hopefully will happen in future, is that the bond markets will actually work and will discriminate between different countries. I think in many ways, the crisis that we've had in the euro is only, I mean, I was rather interested in John Stevens saying that it had all been really planned in advance. The idea was to force further developments. Well, people didn't really tell us very much about these further developments that were going to happen. I noticed Peter Sutherland wrote an article in the FT not so long ago saying everyone had expected a crisis in the eurozone. Well, I didn't hear very much about that during the Maastricht negotiations or during the time when so much abuse was hurled at people who were rather sceptical and hesitant about joining the euro. But I believe there is a long-term problem that is there, and which I think is going to be very severe. In one sense, we ain't seen nothing yet. This was the point that John Peet referred to, that countries like Italy, Spain, Greece, have seen their unit costs vis-a-vis Germany rise by amounts up to 30%, in some cases 20%. They are becoming more and more competitive. And in the absence of an exchange rate adjustment, they face decades of very low growth and rising unemployment. And I think that will put great pressure on the euro and on those countries' membership of the euro in years to come. The anomaly of the euro is that it is a currency without a country. And I've been interested to reading newspapers like the Financial Times. The criticism being made of Germany, identical to the criticism that they make of China, that the government promotes growth too much through the mechanism of exports and does not encourage domestic demand. And papers like the FT rail against the German and Chinese governments for not encouraging domestic demand in the interest of stimulating other countries. I'm a little bit sceptical about this argument. I'm not sure I'd pay a lot of attention to it if I was in the German government. But it does illustrate, you can't possibly really expect the German government that is elected to look after the interests of Germany to alter its policies in ways to make it easier for Italy and Spain to become more competitive. They're just not going to do that in the absence of a European government, or what the French have always desired in the euro, a European economic government. And so I think those very arguments, the railing against Germany for not expanding domestic demand, shows the weakness of the idea of a currency without a government. What is going to happen now? Well, I don't obviously know, but there is a real risk of contagion spreading possibly to Spain. If it does reach Spain, I think this will be a very real crisis for the euro indeed. I don't think it is certain that Germany will bail Spain out. One sees many figures quoted, some of them as high as 400 billion euros for bailing Spain out. I have no idea whether these are right or wrong. But I sense the change of opinion in Germany. I sense the reluctance of the German government to bail Spain out. And what I would guess would happen is that the euro will be partially rescued by the IMF. There will be a rescue partly from the EU and the members of the eurozone, and then there will be an IMF rescue of the euro as well, to which, wait for it, Britain will have to contribute as well, 4.5%. I'm sure you're all overjoyed at that, but we will be paying our part in that too. I agree with what John Stevens said, that there will have to be haircuts for bondholders, both of banks and of governments. I think there will be a rescheduling of the debts of some countries, particularly Greece. I think the EU, the Eurozone, has little option but to move, if it wants to preserve the euro in the long run, towards a fiscal and political union. I don't think it's going to be just enough to say we want everybody to submit their annual budgets to the Council of Ministers before they're approved by their national parliaments, and we want to have peer pressure on fiscal deficits. That will never work, because it's rather like having a jury made up of the criminals. You know, everybody is judging everybody else. It will simply not work within the EU. And I think if they want to make it work, they will have to move towards something like a carbon tax that is used for Eurozone purposes. This is a political project. Helmut Kohl was always crystal clear about that. He famously once remarked, you can't have political union without monetary union and vice versa. That was what it was all about. But I don't think there is now the political will in, I would never have wanted to be part of it, but I don't think there is the political will in Europe to create that political union. What I think will happen is that you will see loads of taxpayers' money chucked at it. Spain and other countries will be bailed out because it is a project in which so much political capital has been invested by the political elite in Europe. Regardless of public opinion, they will carry on with it and they will get through this crisis. I agree with that. I've always thought the euro would not break up in the early stages, but history shows us that currency unions beyond states have often lasted 20 years or so and then broken up. And I've always thought the euro will survive the first recession, but the second recession, or the problem of Italian and Spanish competitiveness in the long run, that is a different problem, and the strains and the crisis will come back and hit them again at a later date. Thank you.
You've been listening to an audio recording by the Economic Research Council. For more information, visit www.ercouncil.org.